History Podcast. As usual, I'm your host, Nishad Carrington. If this is your first time with us, you may not know this, but I'm sure our regular listeners are well aware. The purpose of our podcast is to expose ourselves to the history of ourselves. And one of the things that has really bothered me through formalized education is that the course of history, it's really taught that the African diaspora begins and ends with the transatlantic slave trade. And I say that today because we're going to dive into a person that was on and from the African continent. Now, before I get into the life of Stephen Biko, I'd like to just warn listeners that this podcast will have some instances of violence. And at times, I may have to get a little bit graphic in descriptions, but that's really the only way to truly detail the life and ultimate sacrifice that a nonviolent revolutionary like Biko made during his lifetime. And really what ultimately led to his untimely demise at the hand of apartheid-era security police. Now, that being said, parents or educators, if you have young children listening to this podcast, while I would truly wholeheartedly encourage you to allow them to learn their history, as that really is the premise and purpose of this podcast series, I'd like to ask you to exercise a little bit of discretion in the appropriateness of this episode for your child. Also, in an effort to make clear the difference in the social hierarchy with which the time and place reflected, I will use terms such as Black African and white Afrikaans to reference the racial groups. Now, I know that you can't see this spelled out, but white Afrikaans is actually spelled differently than Black Africans, for those of you who don't know, with white Afrikaans being spelled with a K and two A's, and Black Africans obviously spelled the traditional way of African. I'd also like to give a little bit of a point of reference for the amount of violence and suspicious circumstances that Black Africans faced at the hands of apartheid South Africa. Now, according to very reliable sources, which, you know, due to accounting and, you know, the stories being given from, you know, a lot of times official quote-unquote state media, the best ones that history can account for, there were at least 45 individuals known to have died between the years of 1963 and 1977 while in detention in the hands of the Nationalist Government's Security Police of South Africa. Now, all of these individuals, Stephen Biko included, were denied legal representation and access to friends or relatives during this time of detention. And the causes of death that were alleged by the security police range from multiple instances of suicide. And actually, out of the 45 deaths, 15 of them being listed as suicide, four of those being listed as having fallen down, with one of those persons reportedly having fallen 7 floors during an interrogation, and another being reported as leaping from a 10th floor window during an interrogation. And to an extent, the authorities not even bothering to fabricate reasons for the death of about half of the individuals killed in the year 1977, actually the same year that Stephen Biko was unfortunately killed as well, with his death being listed as a, quote, injured in scuffle. Now, in an effort to provide a point of reference for these atrocities, we will be posting the names and causes of death, the official causes of death, on our website under the tab, same tab as you'll find our podcast episode, for any who care to actually explore the levels of corruption, brutality, and uniformity that the security police were able to operate under then Minister of Police James Thomas Kruger. Now, much of the research for this episode, as well as just a great reference in general about the life and times of Stephen Biko, was actually compiled from a book written by a close personal friend of his named Donald Woods, with the book actually being titled Biko. I encourage you to grab a copy and read it. It's a great read, and it really gives a lot of good insight into what we may not know about apartheid South Africa. Now, there's actually a lot of misconceptions about the totality of the reach of the South African apartheid government. However, Woods's book does do a really great job of providing much of the necessary context, including the fact that Woods himself, for being such a close personal friend of Biko's, was actually placed under surveillance in order to write nothing for 5 years under the threat of imprisonment following Biko's death. And Woods is a white Afrikaan. Now, At this point, it may be a bit necessary to also address the colonial climate that led to apartheid that we, especially in the United States, seem to really know so little about. Now, the nature of the American educational system seems to address the effect of apartheid, namely the imprisonment and eventual presidency of Nelson Mandela, but the history leading to those events, really the cause, if you will, is very interesting and informative in its own right, and likely would clear up much of the clouds that surround the understanding as to why Mandela and so many others were imprisoned and murdered and subject to such harsh treatment at the hands of white Afrikaners, which really were the African minority at the time. Now, Western recorded history of South Africa, and I'll say that purposefully, Western recorded history of South Africa, begins with the arrival of the first white settlers in 1652, when the Dutch established a sailing port out of what is present-day Cape Town. However, archaeological evidence provides traces of some of the earliest human habitation on the planet being found in the same region. Now, when the Dutch settled, they found the land to be then inhabited by the Khoisan people, who were very skilled hunters and herders. Now, the history of colonization provides that South African school children are taught a revised history of this, and with them actually being taught that even to present day, that white settlers and quote Bantu tribesmen arrived at the same time to South Africa. Now, we clearly know that this is false logic, but this is what's being taught. Now, following the Dutch, eventually groups of Germans and French would actually arrive in the Cape Peninsula. In time, however, these groups of Europeans would actually fuse into one white cultural group, evolve their own language called Afrikaans, and whose descendants would be known as Afrikaners. Now, this group's language, Afrikaans, was derived from various elements of the Dutch language with some German influences, but ultimately resulted as a simplified version of these languages. Now, in 1814, following a deal involving Britain, Holland, and Sweden, the British annexed the entire colony post-Napoleon and actually brought in 4,000 British to settle the Eastern Cape area in an effort to quell the continued hostilities between the Afrikaner farmers and black African tribesmen in the area. Now, when the British arrived, they actually did the historically admirable thing and abolished slavery and instituted the freedom of the press. However, the Afrikaners were highly against these acts and considered the British to have been way too liberal to the black Africans. As such, the white Afrikaners migrated northward in what is actually known as the Great Trek, establishing two independent colonies, one in the north called Transvaal and another in the central portion of the country, the Orange Free State, which was actually named for the royal family of the Netherlands. Now, we'll need to jump a bit ahead here and not dig too deeply into the history of South Africa, seeing as to how this episode is actually about Stephen Biko. But without skipping too much, after the Afrikaners moved northward, the British remained in control of the two southern provinces, both being Cape Province and Natal. However, eventually the world's richest gold deposit was to be found in Transvaal. Now, this actually led to economic and political control issues between the Afrikaners and the British colonial government, which culminated in the Anglo-Boer War. Now, after this war, the British handed all of South Africa over to what amounted to a united white Afrikaner nation, led by Louis Botha and Jan Smuts. Now, by 1910, one sovereign state emerged, the Union of South Africa, with the control of the union being provided to the white minority, made up of approximately 60% white Afrikaner and 40% English-speaking British descendants, though black Africans actually made up the vast majority of the populace. Rights and political aspirations for this group were completely ignored. In fact, of the four provinces, only the Cape Province insisted on retaining voting rights for black Africans. Two of the provinces, the ones previously controlled by the white Afrikaners, Transvaal and the Orange Free State, actually granted no political rights whatsoever to black Africans. And the fourth, Natal, was barely less conservative than these two. Now, the minimal rights that black Africans had in 1910 were not to be developed in any fashion and eventually were whittled away almost entirely. Now, we jump forward here to 1913, and there was what was considered to be progressive legislation granting issues of black land ownership, but really, it was only to a specific area, totaling barely 10% of the entire national territory. However, led by the former Boer general, James Herzog, the Nationalist Party was founded. The coupling of white Afrikaner nationalism and anti-black bigotry really led to successful campaigns for the Nationalist Party and eventually led to the Nationalist Party remaining in power for what amounted to the next 70 years. Now, we're going to jump ahead to Stephen Biko. Just wanted to give a little bit of that background so that you understand the climate that we're dealing with and the time that we're dealing with here. Now, Bantu Stephen Biko was born on December 18th, 1946 in Ginsberg Township, South Africa, in actually what is present-day Eastern Cape Province, to Minzinga Matthew and Elise Mamsit Biko. Now, Biko was born the third of four children to his father, who was a government clerk, and his mother, who was a domestic worker in surrounding white homes. However, his father would pass away in 1950 when Biko was only 4 years old. Now, Stephen Biko was a highly intelligent man, even as a child, and eventually through the course of his life, he was actually able to speak three distinct languages. His tribal language of Xhosa, he was fluent in English, and relatively fluent in Afrikaans. Now, in 1964, Stephen actually ended up attending a very prestigious boarding school in the Eastern Cape Province called Lovedale High School. However, there were no freedom of association protections for non-white Afrikaners during apartheid. And as such, Stephen was expelled from Lovedale for his political views. Now, after being expelled from Lovedale, Stephen attended and actually eventually graduated from St. Francis College in the Natal Province. Now, after St. Francis College, Stephen actually went on to study medicine in hopes of becoming a doctor at the University of Natal Medical School. Now, there isn't really much on the record about Biko's formative years, excepting that his positions and views on activism were likely cultivated to a large degree upon entering university in 1966. Now, in 1970, Biko actually married the former Nitsiki Mashalaba, and they actually had two children together. But Biko also had two children from a prominent activist within the Black Conscious Movement, a Dr. Mamphele Ramphele. Now, I do apologize sincerely if I mess up any names. Xhosa is not my first language. I know I've actually probably gonna end up apologizing quite a bit as we go through this, but I'll do my best and hopefully you'll understand where I'm coming from. Biko actually had another child as well with another woman named Lorraine Tabane. At the time of his death, Biko and Nitsiki were still married, though one of the children that he fathered was actually born after his death. Now, in the mid to late 1960s, a huge void was left in the leadership vacuum of Black African politics. At the time, the African National Congress, the ANC, was fractured and was really trying its best to maintain viability. Nelson Mandela was imprisoned and another leader, Robert Sobukwe, was banned. The void for this was ripe for young leadership and a different style of thinking. Now, we're surely going to devote an entire episode to Robert Sobukwe. As he was the founder of the Pan-African Congress, but that's for another day and another time. We're really coming across great follow-up stories and podcast episodes just by introducing our original target topics. Now, by all accounts, Biko never viewed himself as a leader, and he surely never proclaimed himself to be a leader, but he presented a different style and front to his movement. Now, initially, Biko aligned and involved himself with the National Union of South African Students, also known as NUSA. But because this was a multicultural organization, Biko began to believe that Black, Indian, and colored African students needed their own organization to truly advance their own causes. As such, in response, the articulation of the Black Consciousness Movement sprang forward, with Biko actually being one of the main figures and ultimately leaders of this new movement. Now, though he hoped and really tried to shy away from the leadership role in any setting, according to all accounts, from an early youth, he was so naturally a leader that in almost any circumstance, many of his contemporaries would inevitably defer to him in any gathering that he was a part of. And this really spilled over into his adulthood as well. He was, in fact, the main guiding founder and inspiration of Black Consciousness, which addressed itself to Black youth to prepare it for a new phase of the struggle of freedom. Now, after a breaking apart from NUSA, Biko helped to form the South African Students Organization, also called SOSA. Which was actually an all-black organization organized around the concepts of political self-reliance and the unification of university students in black consciousness. And in 1968, Biko was elected as the first president of SOSA, which eventually evolved into the Black Consciousness Movement. Thus, he being the guiding founder and inspiration for black consciousness, as I mentioned before. Now, in 1972, Biko was expelled again for his political activities. This time, he was expelled from the University of Natal, where he was studying medicine, and he actually became the honorary president of the Black People's Convention, an organization that went further than the ANC's civil rights integrationist agenda, and actually merged those views with that of the Pan-African Congress's view on, quote, national land repossession. Now, by February of 1973, the apartheid government had banned Stephen Biko, meaning that he was not permitted to speak to more than one person at a time or to speak in public. Further, he was restricted to the King Williamstown district, and he was not permitted to write publicly or speak with the media. To the greater populace, it was further forbidden to quote anything that Biko said, including any speeches or even simple conversations. Essentially, Biko was banished to a life of political, social, and figurative non-existence. Now, this banishment, the same as was done to Sobukwe, was a way that the nationalist government sought to not only silence dissonance, but also to marginalize views differing from their own amongst Black Africans. Now, after Biko's banishment, the pressure the security police placed on his family and Biko himself was actually increased tenfold. While according to the then current law, the security police could conduct investigations and harassments on those in detentions almost at will, Biko's resolve, intelligence, and spirit of revolution remained literally undisturbed throughout. But Biko's astuteness kept him understanding that the government was looking to discredit him. And a huge part of this campaign was very likely due to the careful way in which Biko conducted himself. He never ventured outside of the confines of the law, maybe towing it from time to time, but never breaking it. He refused to take chances on the important matters, and since he wouldn't break the law or openly violate the restrictions against him, they could never bring him up on charges. Now, in all, during the time of his banishment, Biko faced 5 prosecutions on charges ranging from breaking his banning orders by his talking to more than one person at a time, to traffic offenses, not stopping completely at an intersection and speeding, to, quote, defeating the ends of justice, end quote, by allegedly persuading witnesses to change sworn statements. However, in each instance, Biko was found not guilty. Now, the last charge, quote, defeating the ends of justice, was surely the most serious of the others, with the government attempting as often as possible to bring any charge imaginable against Biko in an effort to drain the cash resources of the Black People's Convention through really hefty legal fees. Now, Biko was alleged to have told a number of Black African schoolchildren to renege on statements that they had actually made to the police after the youth were charged with having set fire to their school. Now, according to Donald Woods, who we're going to have to defer to on this circumstance, what actually happened in the situation was that the school children had come to Biko for some advice and telling him that they had been brutally beaten by the security police, which from what we've discussed and what we'll actually get to soon enough is not unfathomable. And then they told Biko that, you know, the security police had beaten them and forced them to sign confessions that they hadn't even been allowed to read. And they told Biko as well that after hours of interrogations and beatings, they were taken one by one and made to sign at the bottom of a piece of paper. Most of which, this piece of paper, being covered by another sheet of paper. And that the document being presented in the Supreme Court was then presented as a genuine confession. Now, Biko told the children to go to the witness stand, tell the judge the exact same thing they told him. The children were ultimately acquitted. Now, after this act of defiance, Biko was charged with persuading them, meaning the children, to perjure themselves by contradicting their free and voluntary confessions to police officers. The school children were detained all over again and charged with violating the Terrorism Act, being told that they would only be released if they testified appropriately. However, the number of children prevented the prosecution from being able to keep up the case against them. Under cross-examination, the government's case fell apart entirely. The witnesses contradicted themselves so thoroughly that eventually the true story emerged, and Biko was acquitted, and he was released. However, as expected and tried, the case mounted legal fees against Biko and the Black People's Convention. Now, though physically restrained, Biko was not deterred, stating, quote,
"Don't you realize what a man is? It isn't a preventative measure. It is a way of punishing people the state cannot punish under normal law. Many of the banning restrictions are designed simply to inconvenience or exasperate. At first, it doesn't seem bad to have to report to a police station once a week. But after a year, it seems an intolerable inconvenience. Talking to one person at a time is designed to inconvenience you by making you repeat everything you said to the last person, to the next person as well. It is to keep you looking over your shoulder, even in your own home. It is to maintain that kind of tension. Besides, all of these provisions are designed to make one commit technical crimes by breaking the ban. They couldn't make you a criminal before, so they set up artificial provisions, and if you are caught contravening these, you are technically a criminal."
Now, in 1975, the restrictions against Biko were increased even more, with his being prevented from any activities amongst the Black African community, and definitely prevented him from engaging in any sort of subversive activist activity. However, these restrictions couldn't prevent Biko's activism, with him and the Black Consciousness Movement playing a very significant role in organizing the protests that would culminate in the Soweto Uprising in June of 1976. Now, right here I want to note, to not cover the Soweto Uprising in great detail would do a grave disservice to this podcast series and our missions, and I can assure you that we will devote an entire podcast episode to the Soweto Uprising, because the tensions of South Africa and the apartheid government resulted in numerous Black African uprisings. The Soweto is probably the most popularly known one. But a quick touch to Soweto, however, you know, and I just want to throw this out there just to kind of, I guess, build the buzz for the episode to come. It essentially resulted in up to about 700 high school students being slaughtered by the police forces after protesting a decree by the government that all students be taught and learn either English or the white Afrikaan language. In the resulting years, there is now a public holiday actually in South Africa that's actually called Youth Day, and it's observed on June 16th in remembrance of these events. And what amounted from that government decree was that the Black African languages would only be permitted to be used for instruction for religious studies, musical instruction, and physical culture, and what would ultimately over time amount to the removing of the Black African indigenous languages from all scholarly learning. Now, after the Soweto protests and the resulting aftermath, the government stepped up even more pressures on Biko. And on August 18th, 1977, Stephen Biko was arrested at a roadblock while driving to Cape Town. Now, while this did actually violate his banning order, Biko and an associate, Peter Jones, were headed to Cape Town to meet with members of other liberation movement organizations. And they were actually charged under the Terrorism Act, number 83 of 1967. Now, right here, some sources actually state that he was arrested for violating Section 6, and others say Section 83, but as really our prevailing authority for this episode is and will continue to be Donald Woods' book, we'll go with Section 83 as he reports. Now, this act actually allowed for the arrest of anyone suspected of involvement in terrorism, but that definition was so very broadly written that it would actually define anything that might, quote, endanger the maintenance of law and order. And it allowed the person who was detained to be detained for up to 60 days, which the period of detainment could actually be renewed with relative ease, without trial on the authority and the orders of a senior political officer. Now, under this act, there was no requirement that the information regarding the person's detainment be released. So quite often, and surely more often than was reported, people would simply disappear when they were arrested. This is part of the reason why, in the very beginning, and it goes back to that first reference we made, to the people who were admittedly killed while being detained by the security police. There is public acknowledgement of at least these 45 deaths. However, since there was no requirement that any information be released on behalf of the person detained, it's highly possible, and I'm going to argue and venture to say that it's even probably likely, that the official number of 45 is dwarfed by the actual number of deaths and disappearances. Now, the security police initial interrogation of Stephen Biko lasted for over 22 hours, and as was their normal practice, included beatings and systematic torture. And at one point, Biko suffered a major head injury and seduced into a coma. Now, results on the resulting coma are obviously not the most reliable, since the only persons in the interrogation room were Biko and the members of the security police. However, from what we can gather from the official reports, essentially what followed was rather gruesome and brutal. Now, on the morning of September 6th, now keep in mind, Biko was originally arrested on August 18th, so he's now been in detention for 20 days, very likely being subjected to torture and beatings throughout. The police officers detail that a, quote, scuffle, their words, not ours, ensued between Biko and the four officers in the room. At some point in the physical struggle, the policeman punched Biko and beat him with a hose pipe, and then ran him into a wall, at which point he collapsed. Biko was then shackled crucifixion style to a security gate and left chained without medical attention for 24 hours. Now, again, I say that the police categorize this as a, quote, scuffle, their words, not mine. That does not sound as though it was a, quote, scuffle to me. That sounds like it's a beating that went a little further than what they hoped for. Now, on September 7th, Biko was attended to by government surgeons who described his condition as weak, with unclear speech, and numerous external injuries to his face and head. Now, despite obvious neurological damage, the doctors allowed Biko to remain in the cell, naked and chained to the grill. And they didn't bother to record any of his external injuries that he was suffering from. Now, the story in the record will get a bit confusing here, as some sources reflect that another doctor came to see Biko, and what ultimately amounted as the Truth and Reconciliation Commission would cite that doctor's visit as well, but other sources seem to omit this information, so I can't claim what I don't know for a fact. However, in the effort of actually proving more information than not, the other doctor saw Biko sometime between September 7th and September 11th. The timeline between is relatively sparse, so we can actually assume that the visit was between there, and noted that Biko actually suffered from a lumbar puncture that should have indicated Biko was very then likely suffering from brain damage. But the doctors referenced the results of the test he performed as being normal. However, Biko's condition didn't improve in the following days, and one of the first doctors to see him was called back in when he lapsed into semi-consciousness. The doctor then recommended that Biko be taken to a hospital. Now, on September 11th, the security police decided to take Biko to the Pretoria Central Prison, which was 700 miles away, rather than take him to the hospital as was recommended. Biko was loaded naked onto the floor of a Land Rover and unfortunately died shortly after his arrival in Pretoria on September 12th. Now, initially, the first reports that came out from the security police was that Biko died from malnutrition due to an extended hunger strike. However, most questioned this narrative from the beginning. And in fact, Donald Woods references in his book a pact that he and Biko had, stating, quote, "If he should be detained, if he should die in detention, and if it should be claimed that he had taken his own life, I would know this to be untrue." Clearly, he had been killed by security police under the powers granted to them by the nationalist government, end quote. Now, following a thorough autopsy, it was revealed that along with multiple bruises and abrasions, Stephen Biko ultimately died due to a brain hemorrhage from the massive injuries to his head. Evidence that many saw as strong evidence that he had been brutally beaten and clubbed by the security police. Now, while there is still no direct understanding of the levels of torture that Biko endured, and we can assume that as he was a more public figure and a greater target, he suffered worse than his co-detainee. Peter Jones eventually testified to the interrogation tactics that he was subjected to at the hands of the same five police officers as Biko. Peter Jones testified that he was kept naked, beaten with fists, kicks, and beaten with hose pipes as well. When he did not provide the information the police wanted, he was made to stand barefoot on two bricks while holding two chairs above his shoulders, even going as far to say that after one instance of torture, his entire body, shoulders, chest, and arms were full of welts, and that evening he was unable to find any position on his body except for his knees and the palms of his hands and his forehead that were not burning. And resting on those was the only way he could try and get some rest. Now, as previously mentioned, this report from the nationalist government was unsurprising because during the 1960s and 1970s and really up to the mid 80s, the numbers of deaths while in detention increased during periods of militant resistance, with most of these cases being explained by the state as suicides by hanging with the detainee's clothes, head injuries after a fall in the shower, or other quote accidents, and even some being called death by natural causes. Now, I'm sure this will be touched on in the later apartheid episode that we'll do, but just for reference as it relates to Stephen Biko, in 1998, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission reported that the use of torture and assault during interrogation was widespread and systematic. It was used as a tactic by security police at all levels and in all parts of the country, and was condoned by the government as an official practice. Physical beatings were the most common form of torture, followed by suffocation, electric shock, forced unnatural body positions, and in some instances, even sexual abuse, male and female. Police routinely deprived detainees of sleep, food, and drink, regularly kept them naked, exposed them to extreme cold, and even dangled some detainees from windows. The treatment, according to the commission, caused shame and humiliation in addition to gross physical injury, but just as in Biko's case, when the police went too far, it resulted in death. Between 1960 and 1990, it is estimated that over 80,000 people were held in police custody subject to indefinite detention, and the police routinely would detain not only political prisoners, but people from all sectors and walks of life, including children. Due to Stephen Biko's very high-profile nature across the country, news of his death spread very, very quickly, and also was instrumental in publicizing the inhumane and repressive nature of this nationalist government. His funeral services were attended by well over 10,000 people, including ambassadors and diplomats from as far away as the United States and Western Europe. In Donald Woods' book, Biko was later turned into a film called Cry Freedom. Following his death in 1978, after a 15-day investigation, a judge found that there was not enough evidence to charge the officers with murder because there was no eyewitnesses. And in February of the same year, the Attorney General of the Eastern Cape told the world that he would not be prosecuting the case. In response to his death, the South African government paid the Biko family roughly $78,000 in compensation. Now, at this point, there are also some points of contention as to the amount of the settlement, with some sources citing the amount as low as $25,000 and others citing it with estimates as high as $90,000. But right here, the most common number we found throughout our research puts the number at $78,000 American equivalent. However, regardless of the amount paid, this obviously pales in comparison to the relative impact that this man would have had on the social justice movements in his country and across the world. Now, when the commission was established following the end of white African rule in the country, it was announced that the five officers involved in Biko's death were applying for amnesty. Their applications were actually denied in 1999. However, the Justice Ministry determined in 2003 that the statute of limitations had passed, and because of this, no charges would be brought, in addition to a lack of sufficient evidence to prosecute the officers. Now, throughout his shortened life, Biko really, really grew an intense concern for the development of Black consciousness as the solutions to the then current struggles, both in society and as an African people. This ideology is actually what separates Biko from that of Nelson Mandela and Albert Luthuli, a fellow South African and a Nobel Prize winner who we will be dedicating a future episode to as well, so just hang on for that one. Mandela, after release from Robben's Island, and Luthuli were nonviolent followers of Gandhi. But in contrast, Biko actually saw the struggle for African consciousness as having two stages. The first being that of, quote, psychological liberation, and the second being that of, quote, physical liberation. Now, while many would like to compare Biko's nonviolence position to that of both Gandhi and Martin Luther King, that's a stretch at best, and the reason being is because Biko did see the struggle as having two distinct phases. Biko knew that at some point the non-violence would have to give way, so that would surely amount to a violent clash between the Black Africans and the white African minority. In essence, non-violence may have amounted to more of a tactic utilized by Biko than his actual personal conviction. Now, Stephen Biko is often regarded as the founder of Black consciousness, with his political contributions extending well beyond just Black society. But by abandoning the politics of comfort, Biko aggressively challenged the liberal white society to revisit its own levels of consciousness. In this same way, he greatly contributed to the white consciousness and therefore to plowing the beginnings of mutual respect and non-racialism. Most importantly, Biko's early age death, being that he was only 30, the substantive quality of his legacy speaks volumes to the responsibilities facing the youth in all societies as a custodians and champions of democracy. Now, while Stephen Biko didn't originate the phrase, quote, "Black is beautiful," it has become forever associated with his name. It was not only his famous rallying cry to unite the masses, but also a slogan with which the Black consciousness movement was directed under. In his book, which I again encourage you all to read to best understand his philosophy and his thoughts, it's called I Write What I Like. Biko explains the phrase "Black is beautiful" to mean, quote, "You are okay as you are. Begin to look upon yourself as a human being," end quote. Now, if nothing else, through this episode, it's most important to understand the meaning behind which Biko championed that Black is beautiful is the same way in which he lived his life and led the social movement. Empowering the collective masses to believe that they are second to none, believing that they are not only human, but equal to that of their oppressors. The philosophy of Black consciousness therefore expresses pride and determination by Black. At the heart of this kind of thinking is the realization by Black that the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. Merely by describing yourself as Black, you have started on a road towards emancipation. You have committed yourself to fight against all forces that seek to use your Blackness as a stamp that marks you out as being subservient. Bantu Stephen Biko. Now, in closing, on behalf of our staff here at the Black History Podcast and myself, we hope that you thoroughly enjoyed learning about Stephen Biko. A great deal of research and digging went into this episode, and it truly was a team effort. I encourage each of you to pick up the book Biko by Donald Woods, as well as Biko's own book, I Write What I Like. They both are able to go into much more greater detail than we're able to cover here in this episode, especially regarding many of the atrocities that were suffered under the hand of the apartheid and security police, as well as Biko's book, I Write What I Like, actually being a collection of his speeches and his thoughts and his essays. And I will tell you, that book will change your life and your mentality in terms of Black consciousness and that term Black is beautiful. Now, in the event you have any questions or general commentary about this episode, please feel free to visit our website at www.theblackhistorypodcast.com or www.thisiscarrington.com and navigate to the podcast tab at the top. As we develop and grow, you will find an archive of each episode, plans for future episodes, as well as additional links to books and resources that will help you in the journey to self-enlightenment. We encourage you to share our episodes with your friends, your family, your children, your grandchildren, your cousins, the guy from around the corner who you play spades with every Friday, and everyone else. We encourage you to send us your feedback as well. Suggest new topics, events, or people we should cover. Or if you just wish to drop us a line and give us your thoughts or perspectives to an episode we've done, we'll make every best effort to include listener mail and commentary to future episodes. Please, as we take this journey together, we will do our best to present the diaspora in the most objective light, with some occasional commentary presented. But if you come across any errors or mistakes, please let us know. Because as we like to say here at the Black History Podcast, only steel can sharpen steel. Take care, and we hope you'll join us next week.